So, welcome back. How's everybody doing? How many were here last week? David, you were here. We had a homework assignment, which was to look at the verse before class. And I don't know if you've done that or not, but this is a fascinating verse tonight. So we'll get into that. Why don't we start by just asking, as we generally do, whether anyone has any major announcements to make or dramatic developments in your life that you just have to get out?
Actually, it's okay. I'm teaching a mandala course, healing yourself through mandala art. And we'll be taking this at mandala art in different cultures, Hindu culture, Buddhist, and Korean. And I'll be teaching at the Meta Center on Monday evening. I have some flyers I'll pass them out.
Oh, true. All right, so if you'd like to know more about Cher's course on healing through mandala art, then come talk with you after class. Great. All right, why don't we just get right into the verse then, shall we? We begin with an invocation. And the invocation is in the Vedic culture, or India's ancient spiritual culture. There's a protocol. There's an acknowledgement that formality matters, that bringing a certain degree of thought and consideration to what we do enhances what we do. And it offers respect to the subject matter and to the texts and the teachers who have brought us this knowledge. So, before beginning a discussion of the Bhagavad Gita in particular, there's an invocation, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om is called the Bija Mantra. It's the creative sound in biblical language. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. In the Sanskrit texts, that sound incarnation of divinity is the sound Om. And it's described that from that one sound, all the other elements of creation and all manifestations emanated. Namo Bhagavate, Om, is the name Bhagavan, is the representation of Bhagavan. Bhagavan means God, the Supreme Being, who is full of Bhaga. Bhaga means opulence. There are six opulences. I don't think I can remember them now. Fame, wealth, intelligence, beauty, knowledge, and detachment. That's an interesting opulence. All of these royal qualities, but completely detached from them. No particular ego over being God. That's hard to do, but somehow Krishna manages. So, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Now, this Vasudevaya is significant. It identifies Krishna, or divinity in personal form, in a very, very particular aspect. Vasudeva, when in Sanskrit, when you have a long line over an A, it turns an A into an A. So Vasudev is, if in the Puranic texts, the father of God. In divinity, there is the Sanskrit, the definition of divinity is that ultimately the two manifestations are compatible, and the total picture, one the energetic and the other, the energy. So you have the energy of creation, which is a non-manifest oneness of all things, you know, that there is no differentiation. And the energetic source, which is differentiated and endowed with personality and with conscious thought and feelings and emotions. It's that unique individuality of the divine that allows love to take place. For love to happen, there must be two. The lover and the beloved. So in the Vedic conception, Krishna, which is the Sanskrit name for the all-attractive Supreme Being, has form, he has personality, and like we, he has a family, and he has a place of residence, and there's this utterly poetic description of the spiritual realm. So Vasudeva is the name of Krishna's father. By putting that long line over the A, Vasudeva becomes Vasudeva, which means the son of Vasudeva. So what you have in this invocation is a very, very specific enjoining of Krishna, meaning the all-attractive supreme being. Right? Not a sectarian, it's not a Hindu name. Right? It's a non-sectarian way of describing divinity. Son of Vasudeva. And this is Krishna's text. These are Krishna's teachings. So before beginning a discussion, we invoke this identification of the speaker through the phrase Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So if you would repeat after me, we do this three times. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Now you.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay, we are in the fifth chapter. It took us 7 years to get here, but we're glad we're here now. Today we are going to be discussing verse 10. Depending on which edition of the Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada Bhagavad Gita you have, it's either on page 237 or 238. Chapter 5, verse 10. Let's start by reciting the Sanskrit together. I'll chant one line, and then we can repeat together.
Brahmanyadhaya karmani. Brahmanyadhaya karmani. Sangam chaktva korotiya. Sangam chaktva korotiya. Lipyate nasapapena. Lipyate na sapapena padma patram vivambasa. Padma patram vivambasa. Brahmanyadhaya karmani. Brahmanyadhaya karmani. Sangam chaktva korotiya. Sangam chaktva korotiya. Lipyate na sapapena. Lipyate na sapapena. Padma patram vivambasa. Padma patram vivambasa.
Someone like to try? Go for it. Oh, he was volunteering. I see. No, David, you can't do that. That's not allowed. You can't volunteer somebody else to chant. Who would like to try? Cher?
It's a little hard for me to see. I've got my glasses today.
Oh, okay.
Brahmanyadhaya karmani. Sangam chakva korotiya.
Lipyate na sapapena.
Lipyate na sapapena.
Padma patram ivam bhajaso.
Padma patram ivam basa.
Good. Anyone else? Jaideep?
Brahmanyadhaya karmani.
Sangam tayatra karotiya.
Sangam chakva karotiya.
Lipyate na sapapena.
lipyate na sa pape na
padma papakam hisetta.
All right, padma patram evambasa. Good. Okay. So synonyms: brahmani, unto the supreme personality of Godhead. We're going to discuss this first. Adhaya, resigning. Karmani, all works. Sangam, attachment. Chakva, giving up. Karoti, performs. Ya, who. Lipyate, is affected. Na, never. Sa, he. Papena, by sin. Now, this word, there are two things in Sanskrit. There's pap and there's punya. Punya means pious or meritorious works. The opposite of it is pap. Now, Prabhupada has chosen to translate papena here as by sin, which is a somewhat churchianic word or translation. Make sure you leave those skates outside. Another way of translating pap might be to say harmful, hurtful activities. Egotistical, work that is not done for the general benefit, that is not done for God, that is not done in a selfless spirit, something that is done selfishly without regard for others, okay, is pap. Padmapatram, lotus leaf. Elsewhere in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, patram pushpam phalam toyam jome bhaktya payachate. If one offers me patram, a leaf, pushpam, a flower, patram pushpam phalam, a piece of fruit, or toyam, some water, yome bhaktya, with devotion. If you offer me something simple, I'm happy with that. I'll be delighted to receive that from you. It's a lovely verse. It means that no one is excluded from the ecstatic exchange of deepest love and emotion for God, because who can't access a leaf? So there's no need for great scholarship, there's no need for years of meditative, contemplative practice. If you take a leaf and you offer that from your heart, you've achieved the perfection of yoga practice. Your assignment for next week is to memorize verse 37 of the fourth chapter, which says, in essence, the highest form, is it the footnote? Six, now I'm forgetting, which one is it? 647, give me a second here. Yeah, sixth chapter, verse 47. And of all yogis, the one with great faith who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, renders service to me, is most intimately united with me in yoga, and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. So, 647 is your assignment for next week. Where does your yoga take you? It takes you to the heart, where a leaf becomes the impetus for your ecstatic love of God. So here we have Padma Patram. That's Padma Patram, a lotus leaf. Eva, like, Ambasa, by the water. Translation of this 10th verse of the 5th chapter. One who performs his duty without attachment, surrendering the results unto the Supreme Lord, is unaffected by sinful action, as the lotus leaf is untouched by water. All right, one who performs his duty without attachment, surrendering with the results unto the Supreme Lord. Notice there are two sides to this. It's not just to do what you're doing without this proprietorship, this craving over getting the result of what you do, but it's beyond that. It's acknowledging that there's this greater mystery around us and that everything we do is a part of our spiritual life. And making of every gesture an expression of love for God, and through that love for all living beings. So one who performs his duty, One, without attachment, and two, surrendering the results unto the Supreme Lord, is unaffected by pop, sinful action, as the lotus leaf is untouched by water. The leaf of a lotus flower has a kind of viscosity. There's a quality, almost like a wetsuit, you know, where water does not adhere to the surface of a lotus leaf, which is why a lotus can grow in swamp water, and you'll see it as always clean, always pristine and beautiful, because the swamp water just slides off. It doesn't stick to the lotus leaf. It's one of the metaphors given in the Sanskrit texts to describe the position of the Jivan Mukta, someone who has achieved fullness of self-awareness as a spiritual being, walks through this world unaffected by it. Nothing sticks to such a person. None of the contaminations of the swampy world around us can adhere to such an individual, because why? How is it possible? I mean, we have these, you know, these images of, you know, holy beings, you know, somehow like floating through the world somehow. What does it mean that they can live like that in such a transcendental place? What's going on inside them that the things of this world, the attractions of this world, cannot faze them? What's going on inside?
Affection.
Thank you. For? Yes. Yes. What's the one thing? I love asking this question. Has anyone here ever been in love? I mean, fess up. Okay. If you've been in love, and I question that anyone here has not been in love, you remember what that, it is so exciting. It's just like, oh my God, you know, all of a sudden life is worth living. You know, it's like everything irreconcilable, somehow it's working out. You know, why? Because there's somebody there you're connected to. There's somebody there that makes everything worth living and going through, no matter how hard it gets. Why does that happen? Why do we thrill at love? Because that's the nature of the soul. We were made for love, basically. You know, we were made for love. It's what we're all looking for, and it's what makes everything worthwhile. Which is why this beautiful, the Vaishnava, the bhakti vision of creation is so absolutely breathtaking. Yes, the oneness of energy is there, but that's only half the story. How happy could, trust your instincts on this one, how happy do you think you could be just shedding your ego, letting your individuality dissolve away and you become energy? I mean, really? Really? The soul never loses its individuality. There's always, you are a person, not just in this body, you're a person eternally. You don't know who you are spiritually. You don't know yourself in eternity. We're too covered right now. We're very, very, very covered. So that's what your yoga practice is for. That's why you practice yoga. You do not practice yoga for material benefit. You practice yoga to reawaken that internal permanent sense of transcendent identity. Most yogis, I'm sorry to sound judgmental here, but in my experience has been that most people who practice yoga live what we might call an improvised life that's in that gray zone between the provisional life that we know, the life of this world and now, and the transcendent self, which we do not know. We don't know ourselves in eternity. We've been too removed from that for too long. Right? But as yoga practitioners, we know better than to just identify with the physical, temporal world around us. So we're in this kind of fuzzy in-between place, you know, where we're not so stupid as to go back to all of the bad habits, but we're not so enlightened as to just have Krishna in our hearts and be fulfilled with that every minute of the day. So keep chanting. Just keep chanting. Keep practicing your yoga. It will come. It will. You have my word on this. You have, it works. Yoga works. Bhakti works. Just stick to it. Don't, you know, when you get up in the morning, this, you know, in India, when you get up in the morning, the first thing you do before your feet touch the ground is you first offer homage to Mother Earth, and you ask for forgiveness that, my dear Mother Earth, I have to put my feet on you now. Conscious of everything at every moment. Every moment is communing with divinity, with the divine. It's a beautiful thing. Very, very beautiful thing. So start your day with yoga. Actually, there's a beautiful prayer that says, Yashastri Shandhyam Bande Guru Sri Charanaravindam. Three times a day, you should remember your guru and perform some kind of contemplative practice. Morning, afternoon, and evening. You should break up your day somehow. Start your day right. Somewhere in the middle of the day, take a break, step back away from what you're doing, kind of regroup, get your focus again. All right, who am I? I am this body? No, I'm not this body. What am I? I'm the soul within the body. What is that soul? It's a spark of God. So what am I doing here? I'm here to realize myself and to make a contribution to the spiritual progress of others. Okay, now I'm going to get back and do my thing. And then at the end of the day, you come back to that place, right? So bookend your day with your yoga practice and take a break in the middle. So here it's here. Brahmani means in Krishna consciousness. Tomorrow, would you please read chapter 14, verse 27? If you'd like to open your hymnals, it's on 1427 is on page 588, chapter 14, text 27. Would you read the translation of that verse for me, please?
And I am the basis of the impersonal Brahman, which is immortal, imperishable, and eternal, and is the constitutional position of ultimate happiness.
Okay. Brahmano hi pratishtaham. Krishna is speaking here, right? In every chapter, he'll say, Sri Bhagavan Vacha. Bhagavan Sri Krishna is speaking. What does he say? Brahmano hi pratishta. I am the basis of that Brahman energy. Now go back to today's verse. Come back to verse 10. Brahmani adhaya karmani. If Prabhupada has translated Brahmani as unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, well, there you have the reference that says why. But Krishna is confirming that this Brahman energy, this underlying ground of being, as Huxley called it, the underlying unity of all things, is coming from me. I am the basis of that Brahman. You know, if you see a blinding light, anyone ever been to a night game at Yankee Stadium or Shea Stadium? You've never been to a night game? Really? That's part of your homework. You got to go to a night game. Night games are exciting. Really exciting. You walk into the ballpark, and the lights that they use to light up a ballpark, whether it's football or baseball, are incredible. They're so bright that you can actually see individual blades of grass on the other side of the field. You know? I mean, it's hyper real. Hyper real. And the first time I ever went to a night game, my dad took me to a Yankees game. It was 1955 or 56 or something. It's like never having seen before. It's like, you know, my eyes have been opened, And you are, and if you look up at the light board, at first, it seems like this glaring effulgence, like Brahman, right? Just one big, undifferentiated, massive light. As your eyes get acclimated, what do you see? What's on that light board in a ball stadium, a ballpark? Individual light bulbs. It's not just one big glaring effulgence. That light has a source, and that source is individual light bulbs. Well, the Brahman energy is like that. It appears to be an undifferentiated mass of light. If you had the ability, if you had the analytical tools to go down small enough, you'd see that that light is actually the collective effulgence from individual beings. In the Brahman effulgence, those yogis who have achieved liberation, but who have not yet come to the point of bhakti, live in a state of undifferentiated oneness. So they may be in that place where they're thinking, oh, now I've shed my individuality. And that light may appear from the external, from the outside, to be undifferentiated. But at a certain point, it's like, imagine yourself floating in space. It might be a nice relief for a while. You know? Whew, thank goodness, no more tea party, you know. No, thank goodness, no more, you know, problems with this and that and anything. Just close your eyes and just kind of like drift away. How long can you stay like that? You know, an hour? A day? A week maybe? After a while you're going to start saying, oh, I wonder what people are doing back down in Shivamukti. I wonder what class is like tonight. You know, because we're people. So we can turn away from that individuality for some time because we identify individuality with that problematic environment. But when you awaken to your spiritual identity, that's when you really start enjoying the fullness of life. Right? So these are the two halves here. And Krishna says, therefore, I am the foundation of that Brahman energy. That light has a source, and that source is personal. It's endowed with form and personality. So here's the purport. Here, Brahmani means in Krishna consciousness. The material world is a sum total manifestation of the three modes of material nature, technically called the pradhan. Three modes of nature, the three gunas. Does anyone know what the three gunas are? Yeah, David?
Yes, tamas, rajas, and sattvic.
Okay, translation?
Tamas would be inertia, the downside, the negativity, no energy, no movement. Mm-hmm. Rajas would be the busy, fast, high-paced, frenetic mind, life, action of this life. Mm-hmm. And sattvic is that point of that quality of peace, of joy, of grace and equanimity.
Mm-hmm. Nicely said. That was very nicely done. A short way of describing it would often be ignorance, passion, and goodness. But I like your definition because it gives it more fullness. Tamas, the quality of darkness or heaviness. You ever have one of those days where you get up in the morning and it's like, oh, I just can't do it. Just turn and go back to sleep. No energy, no nothing. It's like, I give up. Someone else has got to do it. No. Now, in the extreme, that can lead to escapism through drugs, alcohol.
Depression.
Huh?
Depression.
Depression, right. Eventually, at one of the farthest extreme, suicide. That sense of being overwhelmed by everything. That's the tamasic quality. And there are even foods that are in the guna of tamas. Right? Can you take a guess at what kind of foods would be considered tamasic foods?
Spicy
is rajasic.
Garlic. Is it, you can say garlic.
Mm-hmm. Foods that grow in darkness, foods that are old,
fermented,
foods that have gone bad or stale, foods that do not
reheated.
Reheated. Yes, very good. Yeah, leftovers. I think. Tamasic. Rajasic, you mean like a Maharaja, a king, you know, or Maharani, you know, queen. You've got to get that, you know, zest, that you know, that get up and go, right? As David was saying, you know, what motivates you to achievement, to accomplishment, you know, the high energetic, frenetic sense of, you know, I'm not going to let this energy pull me down. You know, when you reach a point where, no, I'm not going to go back there anymore, I'm going to push through, you know, and you're going to get there. You're going to barrel through somehow. That energy, that's rajasic, passionate sense of getting things done. What spicy foods would be an example of rajasic foods. Sattva, mode of goodness. Now we're in the place. Fresh foods. Pure thoughts. Okay, so now, here's the thing. Sattva is also material. Being in a place of goodness does not make you spiritual. Preferable to rajasic and tamasic, but it's not transcendental. Why isn't it transcendental? Why would a place of goodness not be a spiritual place? What possible reason would there be for?
Because there's material reward.
Okay, you're still working for some kind of a reward. The reward you're looking for may be somewhat more refined, somewhat more nuanced, you know. Being a good person, getting your name over the temple sanctuary door, you know, for your charity, you know, or, you know, being, you know, recognized as a good guy or whatever it may be. But there's still ego there. There's still a working for some kind of a return. Very good. There's also a subtler anchor in goodness, which is that no matter how much good work you do, you've got to come back again into the material world to reap the rewards. You stay here. Goodness does not liberate you. Goodness is the doorway to transcendence. We have to elevate ourselves out of the tamasic state to the rajasic state, to the sattvic state, because it's in the sattvic state, from that place of goodness, where your habits are refined, where you've taken to a yogic life, that you're in a position to move forward into that place of bhakti and love and devotion. It's very hard. It can be done from those other gunas, but it's much harder. It's much harder to do. If you lead a life that's governed by sattvic principles, you know, you're careful about your diet, you're regular about your yoga practice, you're careful about the company you keep, you know, you kind of wean yourself off of the bad habits. You know, and you really make an effort to enrich yourself spiritually. That's a much more likely position to be able to attain a transcendent place where every moment you're fully spiritually aware. But goodness itself is not transcendental. It is not spiritual. So the Vedic hymns: Sarvam hitad brahma, tasmad etad brahma nama rupam anam chajayate. And in the Bhagavad Gita, mama yonir mahad brahma, indicate that everything in the material world is a manifestation of Brahman. And although the effects are differently manifested, they are non-different from the cause. Now, what does that mean? Although the effects, everything is a manifestation of Brahman, and although the effects are differently manifested, they are none different from the cause. Right? There is an underlying unity to all things. From a, let's call it a daily perspective, you look at the world around you, everything appears to be different. The deeper spiritual vision would be to know that despite the apparent differences, there is an underlying unity. Now, we have to make a distinction here, people. Listen up. To say that God is everything is not the same thing as saying everything is God. Do you follow what I'm saying? The texts are describing how everything is an emanation of this divine energy, this Brahman energy. And in that sense, qualitatively, everything partakes of the same nature as divinity. It does not mean that this floor is God. That's a very poetic idea, but it doesn't have any ontological reality. God has his own integrity, his own individual being. Krishna is an individual. But qualitatively, all of creation partakes of his divine nature because it emanates from him. So it says here, although differently manifested, everything shares in that same divine nature. Okay, so that distinction has to be made. All right, I'm going to stop yakking. Anybody have any questions about any of this? The verse again says, one who performs his duty without attachment, surrendering the results unto the Supreme Lord, is unaffected by sinful action as the lotus leaf is untouched by water. I mean, if I can... All right, first things first. Any questions? How are we doing? Okay? All right. No questions about this. No questions. So I want to tell you about my class at Hofstra. Very interesting group. This week, the name of the seminar that I'm teaching there is Holocaust and the Arts. It's relating to the verse. No, I'm not going too far afield. It relates to the verse. The course is called Holocaust and the Arts. What we're looking at is representation of Holocaust history through creative expression. Film, paintings. We're looking at, for example, the work of Felix Nussbaum, Samuel Bach, other extraordinary Holocaust artists. And we're looking at how does the creative mind manipulate the viewer to seeing something the way the artist wants the viewer to see it. Right? If you look at, for example, at the Hofstra Museum this month, there's an exhibit of photography by Arnold Newman. I don't know if any of you know who Arnold Newman is. He passed away, I think, about 8-9 years ago. Arnold Newman photographed the luminaries, if you will, of the 20th century, well-known figures in politics, in the arts, in fashion, and so on. And a lot of his photography, most of it in black and white, is very iconic. So, for example, do you know this picture of Picasso, where he's got the hand over one eye like this? That's kind of like the image that people have of Picasso. That's an Arnold Newman photograph. And we discussed with the curator of this exhibit Newman's techniques, right? So that, just take that for example. His photograph of Picasso fills the entire photograph. That's all you see is Picasso's face. There's nothing around him. There's just that face. But look at what's going on in that face. The shadow, the way he uses shadow. One eye is looking right at you. The other eye is half in shadow. So it's almost like I'm seeing you, you're seeing me, but there's a part of me you can't see, and I'm seeing you from the shadows. So Picasso is observing you. You say, you're looking at Picasso, but he's looking at you. And it's all about what's going on inside him, because that's all there is in this photograph, is Picasso's face. As opposed to a photograph that Newman took of Langston Hughes, black social activist, where in the photograph the angle is not head on as it was with Picasso. It's looking down on Hughes, and all you see of Hughes is this bust, this portrait, and the rest of the photograph is Harlem. So this is environmental portraiture, where the subject, the sitter as it's called, is shaped. Your impression of the subject is shaped by the environment around him. You do not see Langston Hughes working internally. What you see is his place in Harlem, his field of action. So all of Newman's photographs are like that. And what he uses, black and white versus color, light and shadow, framing, environment, texture, layering. There's one photograph of Andy Warhol, for example, where he's got three photographs, and he's literally torn the face of Andy Warhol off of one and pasted it on top of a slightly larger image of Andy Warhol. So you've got these dimensions of Andy Warhol's face, which is very much like an Andy Warhol painting. So, and then, check this out. Who else has a say in the way you're seeing that subject? How about the curator? How about how that photograph was framed? There's a difference between looking at a photograph that's in a simple black metal frame with a white border as opposed to that photograph in an elaborate gold leafed designed wooden frame. It conveys a totally different message. And how about juxtaposition? That photograph next to a photograph of a garbage can will influence how you're seeing that person in a very different way if that photograph is next to a picture of President Kennedy, for example. All of these different layers of mediation influence how we see the world around us and by reflection how we see ourselves. Which reality is reality? Which you is you? And maybe none of those layers that photographer Newman has imposed or that the curator of the museum has imposed have anything to do with the sitter's image of herself or himself. So there are all these different layers of interpretation. And in a sense, we might say that all of history is autobiographical in this way. Everything we know is mediated by these various layers of interpretation, which is why when we talk about scientific information, for example, you can lay data on a table and it can appear to be the most objective, hard, irrefutable evidence of something, and yet 10 people will interpret that irrefutable data in 10 vastly different ways.
Depends on the observer.
Absolutely, it depends on the observer. And you don't have to go down to a level of subatomic particles for the observer to influence reality. If you grew up, for example, in a family where you have problems with authority, for instance, maybe you were abused or your parents were fighting and or, you know, whatever the circumstances may be, you will come upon that information in a very different mindset than someone perhaps who was brought up in a family where they were surrounded by love, encouragement, reinforcement, self-confidence. Maybe there'll be an opening to consider possibilities that that other person who had a very different kind of upbringing is capable of bringing to that observation of the data. So how do you, so where is reality? Where does the reality lie?
So you're talking about subjective truth?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can call it subjective truth, sure. So I'm asking this, I'm posing this as a question for you. What, I think I know everything, I'm up here, yak. Where does truth lie? I'm sorry, a little louder, please.
Enlightened beings see things as they are.
Ah, okay. Enlightened beings see things as they are. That's very Bhagavad Gita. What would enable someone, when we talk about an enlightened being, what are we talking about there? What is happening that such a person... This is also a very important verse in the Gita where Krishna urges Arjuna to approach a teacher, because he says, one who has seen truth can impart truth to you. So what's going on in that person? You had your hand up.
Well, I was just to say that when we're covered with all these layers and your ego is made up of our memories and we have pattern behaviors and reactive behaviors, you know, based off our memories and our past lives. And so...
Yeah, that's actually a very succinct description of the Gita's explanation of what an enlightened life is all about. It's not that you turn your back on who you are in this world. It's not that you... I made that mistake. When I first moved into a temple, a Krishna temple, I was 19 years old, right? The only child of divorced parents. So I was hardly there through some, bolt of enlightenment. You know, I was there because I was a troubled kid. And what was the sensation of moving into it? Oh, it was relief. Like, oh wow. Yeah, like, I'm a spiritual being now. Oh, yeah. You know? I don't have to deal with that family crap anymore. You know? You know, now look at me go, you know. So it's not enlightenment. It's a running away from a problematic situation. So sometimes, you know, people who take to a yoga life, they're not doing it from some positive attraction. They're doing it from some negative repulsion. You know, the rest of the world is so bad, you know, that I'm just going to go take my yoga now. But that description that you're pointing to, which is someone who has worked through, sometimes we call it, you know, inner work. You know, they've done their inner work for so long and so assiduously and so effectively that they've been able to move down deep enough to a place beneath all of those other psychic layers to nurture the soul and to move from that place of yourself, true, not just intellectually understanding that I'm not the body, I'm the soul, but realized knowledge. That's an enlightened being who has understood to the point of realizing, which means to take knowledge and be able to put it into practice at every moment. That's what realized knowledge is. That's what wisdom is. That person can work from a place of balancing properly the acceptance of the life we have while knowing that there's more to me than this. Now, I'm wording this very, very carefully because the general tendency is, like me at 19, you know, Zeigesinte hate, you know, like, okay, goodbye. Now I'm over here now. You know, you want, just send me a letter if you want to talk to me. Right? That's not the yoga life. You look at the lives of the real, you know, tzaddikim, you know, the great realized being. They're in the world. Many of them were married people. They had families, you know. They weren't, you know, shaved men in robes. You know, they were, first of all, there were a lot of women. Some of them were children. You know, but they'd come to this place because they had worked through all of those mediated layers of self to come to know themselves at that deepest level. And when you're in that place, you no longer have to walk away from problems. You can transform the situation just by being there. Huh? There's no need to run away anymore. You run away because you're scared and you don't know who you are. That's a position devoutly to be wished. Yeah.
I have a question about Sangha. So the work basically is he purporting.
I'm a little louder, I'm
Sangha,
sorry. Sangha.
The work, performing of work.
Where is that? Is that part of the verse?
Yeah, part of the verse. The duty, yeah, what's called.
Sangham chaktva kroti ya. Okay, attachment. Giving up the attachment of the work performed. Okay.
It is interesting that it's constantly related to the Bhagavad Gita, always relates back to our duty or, you know, our work. Because it does feel this way. Everybody has their path somehow. I mean, there's things that you do better than others. So it's just. What's the root of the work? Where do you find your work? Where do you find your
Would you? How do you follow your bliss?
Yeah, sometimes that's a confusion. But in my case, I'm lucky, but I try to resign work to the divine.
Yeah.
Or, you know, in this case, we're performing that duty. Krishna.
Well, young man, you know, in the Vedic times, you know, in the wisdom cultures and the faith cultures, where contemplative life is honored, not like here, which is where it's looked upon as something a little weird, but where it's honored, you would be in close proximity to your teacher, and your teacher would know you. You know, a spiritual teacher is different from an academic teacher. A spiritual teacher is kind of part psychologist, part therapist, part, you know, instructor, part mentor, part. And because you would have regular daily contact with your teacher, that person would know you. And it was often from starting at a young age, like age 5. So as you grow, this person sees what are your inclinations, what are your skills, what are your aptitudes, where would you be happy working, and can guide you in that direction. I got a bunch of undergraduates at Hofstra who, I don't know what they don't know why they're there. And I don't know them. They don't know me. You know, it's tragic. You know. And I cannot guide them. You know, I can try, you know, I do a little song and dance and maybe try to make it interesting for them. But I can't really guide them because there's not that lack of intimacy. As a matter of fact, today there are strict rules in institutions of learning that prohibit you from having that kind of a more intimate contact with your students. Because it's considered, you know, you don't go there, you know. No. But in the Vedic age, in the Vedic culture, still today in some parts of India you can see it, there's a very, very close, it's like family, really close connection with your guru, with your instructor. So that there you've got a better than average shot at being directed toward a career that's really going to be right for you. You know, my God, these poor young people coming in, ask Tamar, she's got students. They come out of school, you know, they don't know where to go, you know, what to do. They have no, you know, they end up waiting tables because they have no idea what, you know, what to do with themselves. You know? Oh, I want to be in film. No, you don't. You have no idea who you are. What are you in film? Yeah, yeah. What's your name?
Amy.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice having you. No, that's beautiful. That's lovely. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
It's very difficult because you're starting at a disadvantage. It's like saying, okay, I'm in this mess. How do I make the most of it? Basically, you know, this may not be my dharma, this may not be my bliss, this may not be where I was supposed to be. Let me see if I can carve out of this situation a place for myself where I can be a contribution and where I can be satisfied and content doing what I'm doing here. Good luck. I mean, you know, it can be done, but it takes a lot of, you know, deep breathing, you know. Because very often, it's like choosing the wrong partner, you know? Can you make it work? Yeah. I guess, you know? You know? But if you'd had a little help in the beginning, you know, to figure out how to partner well, maybe you could save yourself some heartache and time and you know, suras, as we say in Sanskrit, you know.
That's what teachers are. Shouldn't be everywhere.
Yeah, you know. So therefore, thank you, Amy. Therefore, those of you who are training to be yoga teachers, who are now yoga teachers, you have what I've quoted this before. Thomas Aquinas described as a secundum quid. You have a second layer of responsibility. It's like people who go into law. You know, you're not. That's not. Law is not a job. Law is a responsibility. You know, you're there to protect the pillars of the democratic process, and so you have to take that very seriously. And if you're going to be a yoga teacher, you also have that secundum quid. You have that secondary level of obligation, not just to give a good asana class, but to know and represent the pillars supporting yoga culture, so that what you're giving to your students is the full experience to which they are entitled. Very serious responsibility. Okay, you want to have your students get ready to do an RT? Is it too early?
Can I ask a question? Huh?
Yeah, sure. Let me answer tomorrow's question for you.
So I was in this discussion with a few yoga teachers, and we were talking about what happens in a situation where you say you're with a person or a particular situation that arouses kind of like citta vritti, that arouses the mind's kind of fluctuations that you don't like in a negative way, you know, that causes you to be negative. So one side of the conversation was saying, well, you should, one strategy to deal with that is to avoid that situation and to leave it and not be in the presence of people that cause that in you, even though you know it's coming from you, but it's just, you know, that you can't express it. And the other side of the conversation was saying, well, you shouldn't run away from those situations, but you should try to work with them and deal with them. And I know this is probably like very specific to each situation, what you should do, but I was wondering if there was sort of like a general answer you could give to that in general.
See, the thing is that the answer to that kind of a situation or an effective formula for dealing with that situation can change from day to day. Today, you might be in a vulnerable place where the best thing you do is just move away from that because it's just going to really make you more miserable. Something may happen, and if you continue in your yoga practice and you're evolving, next week or next month or a year from now, you might be better equipped to handle that situation. So it's not the situation itself. It's where are you on your yogic path? And the responsibility is to know yourself well enough and to be able to evaluate where you are in terms of your own spiritual progress, so that you'll know whether you are prepared now, at this time, to handle that kind of a situation that's causing disturbance, or whether you should distance yourself until such time in the future as you may be better prepared. That's not an artificial renouncing. That's just common sense. You don't want to pretend to be more spiritually advanced than you are. That's going to get you into trouble, and it's going to get everybody else into trouble. That happens a lot, I can tell you, and you know, we've seen it. To use the most obvious example is when someone, you know, sits here like I do on the, you know, teacher's blanket, you know, the Vyasa-san, and this is a powerful position. You know, people, oh, Yogeshwara. And whatever, and you know, there's something. It also happens in schools where there's, it's called transference. You have, in my case, you know, young girls, 18 years old or whatever, and all of a sudden you're a little bit more than just their professor. You know, so you got to be on the lookout for that kind of thing. And unfortunately, sometimes people take advantage of that. That's tragic. That's tragic. Where, you know, where you're someone who is not sufficiently qualified, they're not adequately progressed in their own spiritual life to be able to handle that kind of a responsibility, and they end up succumbing to temptation, or they end up, you know, just terrible. It's the worst thing in the world when that happens. So that's an extreme case. I'm not exactly sure whether it fits the model that you were describing, but certainly if you know, if you're honest with yourself, I think your own intuitions will tell you whether to fight or flee. That's the dictation of the Paramatma in the heart. This all comes back to Krishna, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. comes back to Krishna. There is an intuition in the heart which is described in the Bhagavad Gita as Paramatma. And it is that voice of wisdom from within you, which is Krishna. It's an actual avatar, an incarnation that dwells with the soul in the heart. That is, you might call it the voice of higher wisdom that is within you. And if you turn to that, again, with this mentality of how may I serve you? This is why it comes back to this verse here. How may I serve you? Not just detached from the world, but I'm here now. How can I be an instrument for you in this situation? More often than not, you'll get some kind of guidance there. And the guidance might be, you're not ready for this, just move away. And if you're listening, you know, and if that ego that you were talking about isn't interfering, which we'll very often do, we'll say, yeah, well, it's not really what I'm hearing. What I'm hearing is, I actually am ready. You know, so if you can kind of separate the ego, it's there for you. It's there for you. And I'll do this again. I do it almost every week now. That's why we're here together on Tuesdays. Bring it to class. You know, this is meant to be a safe environment. You have a dilemma of some kind. You're facing a choice that you're not quite sure how to make. Bring it to class. Talk about it. These are friends here. These are people who love you and care for you. You know, they will give you an honest, you don't have to accept what they have to say, but they'll give you an honest reaction. They'll tell you what they think. Who else are you going to ask? You know, your family? You know, what are they? They don't get you. You know? Yeah. Oh, you know, she does yoga. You know, you got friends here. Yeah. You have a dilemma? Well, you know what they say, when you're handed a dilemma, make the dilemmanade. Sorry.
Well, I just moved into this new place, and I was
going
to say, you know, I had a lot of hesitation and feeling like on the surface it looked like a really good place, but then having this hesitation, not really know why. But now that I'm there, I feel like, okay, that was my intuition. Basically what it is, I mean, it's a beautiful space, but one of my roommates has lots of animals, but I just feel like she's not connected to any of her animals. And so I feel, you know, they're either caged or they're locked up in the shut away into the kitchen. My room's out of the kitchen. So it just bothers me. It's just like, there's always, you know, I'm thinking, why does she have animals if she doesn't take, you know, want to be with them at all? You know? Mm-hmm. Her boyfriend really cared for her and he comes over. And so then I feel like I should spend time with them because she's not, they don't really care.
Oh, it's a very practical case. What are her choices?
But I don't have animals. First
weekend,
then all three dogs slept in bed with me.
I didn't
move out.
All right, so option A is you could look for another place. Okay, that's option A. What are some other options? Huh? Talk to her. If you're really feeling like she's not connecting with her animals, you could talk to her and say, you know, these are living beings too. Ah, well, isn't that a matter of how you talk to her?
I know. You know, and then she has a rabbit. There's three dogs, three cats.
All right, well, we don't have to get into the whole menagerie. But the point is there are many different options. And maybe a lot of it depends on how much you're willing to go out on a limb and present yourself from your heart what you're sensing about these animals.
This woman has
rabbits make you slide.
This woman has problems?
Absolutely.
Okay, so the risk in Plan B is that she could ask you to leave. You know, if you don't like, you know, my thing, okay, you have 1 month's notice. All right, so these are the things that you have to weigh.
Try to consider where someone's coming from.
versus, like, you see her as maybe not having a connection with her animals, she could feel completely connected to them, even if they're in cages, and you might just not be getting there. So, I don't know, I mean, I just thought, you know, she's really busy with school, I know she's having problems with a boyfriend, you know, but I just, it breaks my heart to think, I have an aversion to animals in cages, and, you know, just being, really big animal.
All right, so here's a very good example. Those of you who would like to address the dilemma of the animals in the apartment after we have our artik, let's gather in this corner and we'll talk about what some options are. Okay. Thank you for speaking up. All right. Rodney.
Yeah. I would say yoga and everything else is beautiful, so we're all good. The thing is, you gotta make it work for you. Yoga is a creation of one. Like you're making the world with your practice, it all's gonna bring in everything you're looking for. You wanna know who you are? The answer is, when you start what you're looking for, you will find yourself in that start. So you practice yoga. Yoga will find everything in the world, but it's even beyond that. When you walk in the door for, you will find your freedom, all different things that you never felt in your life. It's unbelievable. So you have to bring in an early part of your life starts and then bring it into the tool for after using your posture, breathing, chanting, what he has in Hare Krishna's, whatever it is that's right for you. When you make up the mind as one, it doesn't matter if you breathe, chant Krishna, do the postures, do meditation, you already started. You already premeditated, you're in a row already. If you got so much love, all the gifts inside, the world's a gift. The yoga is the greatest. I think it's the answer to after when we're born. And then after comes is the yoga. And you know all the things that you're looking for. And you're just unattached. He was talking about surrender. And the yoga is unattached. The yoga is unattached. It's all he is. He's just going to teach you. You don't even have to surrender. He's already there. That's what it comes to you. It won't be your surrender is attachment now. So you have to go through again. What you want to find is you're using this with the postures and the breathing and the chant, using it as a tool. It all works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you believe in what you're doing, you'll definitely find everything you're looking for. And it's beyond that. That's the whole thing. You'll never realize how far you go. That's why it's the computer of all computers. It's
the yeah, that's quite true. It actually is so much more than you could even imagine. Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you, Rod. Thank you. Okay, so artik time. All right. Thank you.
We're going to give you some chant books, and I'll explain the artik ceremony that we're doing. So if you could just pass it around, and it looks like you might need to share something.